Nightly Business Show on Cambridge 105, presented by me, Sam Davis. As you may remember, in our last edition, we spoke to the owners of three local SMEs who have decided to ignore the forecasts of continued problems for the UK economy and who have made big investments in their businesses. With the help of Michael Wells of Third Light Limited, Rocco Balzano of Balzano's Delicatessen, and Helen Harrison of Granta Dental, we explored why they have gone for growth at such a challenging time, how they funded it, what obstacles they encountered along the way, and most importantly, whether it has been worth it. In this show, we follow up on some of the issues raised by Michael, Rocco, and Helen. Their experiences in raising finance for their investment programmes confirm that the main high street banks are still cautious about lending to small businesses. So today's show looks at a new source of local funding established specifically to meet the financing needs of SMEs. And although last month's interviewees were very positive about the benefits of taking the risk to expand, it's clear that not all investment stories have such happy endings. So we also talked to a local insolvency practitioner about what can be done to help businesses which have reached the end of the line and are unable to continue trading. But first, to get a better understanding of the funding side of the equation, I spoke to Paul Folks-Davis from the Cambridge and Counties Bank. Paul, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me this morning. I'm here because you are the chairman, I believe, of something called the Cambridge and Counties Bank. Now, many of our listeners may not have come across this institution, so could you start by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yes, well, the Cambridge and Counties Bank is a very small bank and B, quite a new one. We've just had our 1 year's anniversary. The bank was set up by two shareholders, one of which is Trinity Hall, one of the oldest colleges in Cambridge, of which I'm fortunate enough to be bursar, and the other is the Cambridgeshire Local Government Pension Fund. Both of the shareholders thought that in these rather difficult times, there was a need on a local level to provide funding to small and medium-sized businesses that were not actually getting what they needed from the clearers, who have, as we know, legacy and other problems and are trying to rebuild their balance sheets by not being as omnipresent in the lending market as they have been in the past. So that was the genesis of this. It wasn't entirely altruistic. I thought, and I still believe, that this is a very good investment for Trinity Hall's endowment. We're trying, obviously, to grow the college's endowment all the time. There's a lot of pressure on higher education funding, as people know. So the stronger the financial covenant of the Cambridge colleges, the more effective they can be.
And the name of the bank suggests a very specific geographical focus. Why have you decided to concentrate on that geography?
Well, both the shareholders are clearly Cambridge-based. The way in which we were able to structure this is quite a difficult thing from a regulatory point of view to set up a new bank. What we were able to do was buy the assets and liabilities of an existing bank, and then the FSA, as it then was, would be the PRA now, gave us a fresh license to begin a new operation. Now, that bank was based in Leicester, and most of the bank's operations, if you like, are still based in Leicester, though we also have an office in Cambridge. So we have what we call heartland regions, which are best described as East Anglia and the East Midlands, where we are expecting to focus a majority of our lending activity, about 60%. And then the rest of the other 40% would be sourced nationally, which is in line with what the regulators like to see. They don't want to see too much of a geographical concentration.
Right, okay. And just so we're clear, you mentioned earlier that the bank was established to service the SME market. Who do you think of as your targets in terms of both the loan side of the business but also the depositor side of the business?
Well, at the moment, both sides of the balance sheet are either being serviced by us on loans, or we are receiving loans or deposits rather from businesses, and it's all only SME. So we don't have a retail deposit business at the moment, although we may go out with a product that does that later in the year. We see our target market as the smaller end of small and medium sized enterprises. So companies with a turnover of probably sub a million, fewer than 25 employees, and looking for loans of between £50,000 and £1 million. So we are trying to look after the smaller end of the market.
And you mentioned that you've just celebrated your first year anniversary.
Yes.
I gather that you're sitting now on about 100 loans distributed of a total value of about £40 million. Is that right?
That is right.
And that's where you thought you'd be at this point?
It's probably slightly ahead of where we thought we'd be. And more importantly, we expect by the end of this year to be at about £100 million. And that's quite a bit further ahead than we thought we'd be. What we've discovered is that there is a lot of appetite for lending on this scale. It's a good idea, I think, for a new bank to try and build its book of business. At some point, the clearing banks will start feeling better about themselves and they'll come back in the market and our competition will increase. But at the moment, we are what is commonly known as a challenger bank, and we are trying to build a reasonable book of business in the first few years to sustain us when times get more competitive. At the moment, we're quite surprised. About half the loans that we're making are not fresh loans, but they're further loans or renewals of loans to people who already have borrowings outstanding with the clearers, who are not willing, for the reasons that I've already mentioned, to carry on with them. So 50% of our book is fresh business and 50% is existing business.
And has your understanding of the market that you're serving evolved over the last 12 months, or do you think you're still heading in the same direction that you initially identified?
I think we are heading in the direction that we initially identified. The methodology for getting there is slightly different than we might have expected. We expected most loans that we made to come into the bank directly. In fact, the vast majority of them are coming via brokers. That's good because brokers do a certain amount of quality control, vetting, due diligence. Bad from a profit point of view because we have to share our commissions with them. Although we're doing higher volumes, profitability is slightly lagging where we'd hope we'd be, but we're catching up now very quickly. So it's all looking pretty good. We only lend on a secured basis. We've been able to do that all the way through with high-quality security. So we're very happy with the book that we're building. There's a certain amount of legacy pensions and SIP business in our book, which we continue to service.
And I understand that one of your USPs is the fact that you take a very individual approach to approving loans. So you have, if you like, reintroduced the notion of a local manager to actually understand the business proposition that's in front of you. Is this similar to the approach that's taken by, for example, Handelsbank, who are coming into the UK market now?
Yeah, Handelsbank's obviously a much larger operation with a big retail focus, so they're making a lot of domestic mortgage loans and things like that, which we're not doing. But in terms of a manager who knows the business that he's lending to, yes, that is our business model. And one area where I think we are probably more effective than any other bank in the country is that if somebody makes an approach to us, we will look at their business and give them a decision in principle within 48 hours if we can. Now, to actually make the loan, do all the research on the security, get the broker's valuations, etc., that can take many weeks. But we will try and give somebody an answer very quickly, and I don't think anybody else does that.
This is In Your Company on Cambridge 105 with me, Sam Davis. My second interviewee today is Chris McKay, who is a partner in the Cambridge office of the Business Rescue and Insolvency Practitioners, McTeer, Williams & Wood. I started by asking Chris how it feels to work in a sector which depends for its revenue on other businesses in financial trouble.
That is an exactly good summary, because most people will only come and see an insolvency practitioner when they've really got no other choice. We like to try and persuade people to come to us a little bit sooner than that, but often there's only a cataclysmic event in their life will bring them to us.
And you talk about trying to pick clients up a little bit earlier before that cataclysmic event has happened. What sorts of things would prompt them to come and seek out?
What prompts them to come and seek me out is that they've had an event occur in their business that they really cannot deal with. And that event can be the bank has closed the bank account down, they've had a winding up petition, or they've had some other fundamental threat to their business that means that they really have got to, there's no alternative at that stage but to face the inevitable that their business is going to close.
And when people come to you, and spotted the pretty much the opening line on your company website is, it's not all doom and gloom, but presumably there's some fairly tough talking that has to go on.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes see myself almost as a counsellor in trying to persuade people that, what their business has been about isn't working any longer. And they've got to face reality and do something different, because if they carry on doing what they're doing, they're going to not get anywhere. So a lot of the time I'm trying to persuade people that they need to make a difficult decision.
And that kind of difficult decision could be the family, walking away from a family business and bringing in another management team, or it could be deciding that the business simply isn't viable and that they should cut their losses effectively.
Yeah, I mean, for most people, they still don't like the idea of not paying their creditors. There is a lot of moral obligation still in business, surprisingly, I think, sometimes. I wouldn't say that's true of everyone I see, but a lot of people I see, they want to make sure that they're paying off their creditors. Nobody really comes to me and says, I want to dump my creditors and I don't really care. They all care. So they often have this very difficult decision to make. And I say, well, who's going to be paying off these creditors? Is it, the business isn't going to be able to pay them off. Are you going to take them on personally? And then as soon as it starts to get a bit more personal, then they start to see that there might have to be some difficult decisions to make, and that means not paying people.
So what's the range of approaches you can offer to help them? I mean, presumably there's a sliding scale of interventions that you can offer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's at the end of the line, if you like, there's formal liquidations which bring the business to a close. The directors appoint me as a liquidator, and my role is then to sell the assets, turn it into cash and pay the creditors. So that's at the end of the line. But further up the line, there are options that allow me to carry on trading the business while I try and find a buyer for the business. And that could be the existing management team, or it could be a complete third party. There are options where a formal deal is done with creditors that allow the business to carry operating pretty much as it is, but ring-fencing the creditors and putting them into a pot where you pay some money regularly.
Is that what's known as a CVA?
Known as a company voluntary arrangement. There's not many that are happening, but there are an increasing number of those happening. I think creditors are seeing them as a better way of getting value out of an insolvent situation. Everybody knows a company goes in liquidation, the poor old creditor is not going to see very much money. Maybe a CVA is a different approach. It's a softer approach as well. It allows the business owner to carry on running the business normally.
And keep employees, presumably.
And keep employees, yeah.
Okay, so your company website has some very interesting case studies about organisations you've worked with and how you've helped them. The one that caught my eye was a really quite substantial family business turning over 10 million a year, which nevertheless found itself requiring your services. Could you talk a little bit about what the situation was there and how you helped them?
Yeah, often situations have got sort of very specific reasons why they fail, and this one had a fairly specific reason why it failed. And this failed because part of its business required it to make certain payments to the government. And it failed to make those payments to the government. And the government didn't really notice for a while, and it built up. Other suppliers to the business, particularly the factoring company, learned of this and were nervous. And so it had a knock-on consequence that they reduced the amount of money that they were willing to lend to the business. And that had a knock-on consequence that they then couldn't afford to pay their creditors as and when they fell due. So we got involved, and initially we placed the company into administration, and that's a process that allows the administrator to take control of the business and run it. And we ran it with a view either to try and find a buyer for that business, which is the usual exit route out of administration, or we also ran it with a view to seeing if we can put some more management in and allow it to carry on under its own steam and take it through a company voluntary arrangement. We did that. It took. I'm summarising here because this took many months to reach this conclusion and to get it to happen. But we found an interim manager, and he subsequently became the long-term manager of the business, the managing director. But we had a very difficult conversation to have with the family that owned the business, because the feeling was, for most of the creditors, that they weren't happy allowing this business to continue in the same ownership. And so we had to persuade the owner that the alternative was the business was going to go under completely, or they could reduce their shareholding down to 5 or 10%, and at least they might have some upside in the future. Bearing in mind their business was already worth nothing, so it was a sort of not a difficult decision for them, but an emotionally difficult decision.
Yeah, because financially difficult. This was a business that had been in their family for three generations.
That's right. Nobody wants to be the generation that loses the family business. So we were able to give them something to hold on to, if you like. So that's what happened, and that was about 5 or 6 years ago. The business has come out of the CVA, very successful. It's now generating £500,000 profit a year, and it's trading on its own. So it's a very successful outcome in that case.
So that's a great example of what can happen when the right help is deployed
at the
right
time. I mean, they came to us, and there was something that we could do. What I find difficult is when people come to me on Thursday saying they haven't got enough money to pay the wages on Friday. I really don't have a magic wand, but if they'd have come to me a week or two earlier and said, we think we're going to have a problem, then there are other options that we can look at.
Now, your company is active across East Anglia, but this being the Cambridge office, presumably you're particularly involved in the high-tech sector.
Yeah, and they're always a different kettle of fish. The business I was talking about a few moments ago was a family business, and family money was involved. Whereas in the Cambridge sector, there tends to be more institutional funding, more wealthy one-off shareholders, and most of the businesses have a complicated capital structure. A number of individuals have put money in over time, often 2, 3, 4, 5 funding rounds, and the ownership is very distinct from those that are running it.
And again, referring to material on your website, I think you've recently been involved with a company called, is it Biotica?
Biotica, that's right, yeah.
And has that had a similarly successful outcome, or are we still waiting on that one?
That one was a fairly recent case, and we sold the intellectual property. We had 3 or 4 separate deals to sell that, so we managed to package it up in such a way that we could sell it off in little bits. I think we raised in excess of £500,000, and we're hopefully in the process of just paying a dividend to creditors, which ought to see them get about half of their money back, which in my industry is a pretty good result for creditors. They may not see it like that, but the usual is sort of 5 to 10 pence in the pound, and we're at 50 pence in the pound, hopefully.
So can we talk a bit about the creditors? I mean, you're working for the company that's in distress. Do you have sympathy for the creditors who...
Well, technically, I am working for the creditors.
Right.
It's quite a strange way that I get into companies, because initially the company directors come and see me and they say that they've got a problem with their company. And I have to take a very... moral hand, if you like, and I'm assuming that I'm going to be at some stage working for the creditors, so I have to make sure that whatever deal is done in the interest of the creditors, not the interest of the directors. So it's quite a difficult sell to the people that are initially instructing me that I'm going to be at some stage acting for somebody else.
Yeah, I can see that.
And it's difficult to see how else it could work without involving two different sets of firms, and then that would just be more complicated. But it does kind of work. You know, if you looked at it from the outset and said, well, you know, you're bound to be conflicted because you're taking instructions from one person and acting in another. But our industry is quite good at taking that role on, and somebody's got to take the role of sort of mediator amongst everybody. And everyone's got different roles and agendas, so... It is an odd role, but essentially we're working for the creditors. When we're instructed in a formal insolvency process, we're working for the creditors. They're the people that agree our fees. They're the people that benefit from our work. We have a fiduciary relationship with them.
And how does that work out? There's this particular form of dealing with administration called a pre-pack, isn't there? And I know that's been getting news coverage recently.
Pre-packs can be quite controversial. Really, a pre-pack is a deal that is lined up before the company formally goes into administration, and then once it comes into administration, the administrator signs off on the deal. So it's the administrator that's making the sale. And the administrator is making the sale, and he's making the sale in the knowledge that he's acting on behalf of the creditors. So this goes right to the heart of what I was saying earlier about we take an instruction from somebody and then we're acting on behalf of the creditors. So when we're in those negotiations, we are effectively negotiating on behalf of the creditors. Creditors often see that it's a nice cosy deal with the directors, because often the business is sold back to the directors. Not always. In some cases, it's sold on to third parties, but it's always done quickly and as creditors would say, it will be behind closed doors. In reality, it has to be done that way, because value disappears out of the business faster than you can tell when the business is insolvent. If somebody flags up and says, hey, we can't pay all our creditors, then nobody's going to want to buy that business. The employees don't like working for it, thinking they're not going to get paid. Supplies will dry up, so you won't be able to deliver the work in progress that's happening. So it has to be done quickly, and it has to be done in a relatively closed way. But the insolvency practitioner has got to follow certain procedures and has got to disclose information. He's got to market the business. He's got to explain his rationale in his actions. And he's ultimately answerable to the creditors. So the way I try and explain it to creditors is, look, the process that's gone through here is to try and get you more value, more cash. If I've seen the directors and told them that the business is broken and bust, it's broken and bust. My role then is to try and maximise the cash I can get out of the situation. And often that is by achieving a pre-pack sale, because the costs involved in doing that are low compared to the cost of me running the business for 3 or 4 weeks while I try and find a buyer. And I will also normally get more money on the table by doing a quick sale where the business can continue, rather than there being some sort of break where the business goes into administration and I trade it. So I'm trying to get the best deal for creditors. If I don't do the pre-pack, the answer is still that the business is going to fail, and you're still going to lose money. You'll just get less money back because I won't be able to get such a good deal from the assets.
Okay.
That's the logic of a pre-pack.
Yep, okay.
It's not very often easily understood by creditors.
No, I guess it's an emotional time.
It's an emotional time all around, yeah.
Now, you, I suspect, of all the people I've spoken to over the last year's worth of programmes, are in a particularly privileged position for taking the temperature of the Cambridge business scene. Do you see trends in the kinds of people who are approaching you? Is it old businesses? Is it relatively adventurous startups? Or is it just you never know who you're going to pick up the phone and talk to?
It's very interesting because whenever I say to people what I do for a living, I'm an insolvency practitioner, they say you must be snowed under with work. And it's just quite simply not true.
In Cambridge?
In the UK in general.
Oh, okay.
And particularly in Cambridge. I mean, Cambridge is its own little bubble and it does. I will say that Cambridge doesn't really rely on trading as a sort of a manufacturing business would rely on buying and selling things. It relies much more on the level of funding because there's so much work that is pre-revenue in Cambridge where it's development work. And the funding's holding up. Cambridge is in this little bubble that it does really well. Having said that, there are businesses that fail in Cambridge and at similar levels, if you like, to other regions. But it's not the businesses that you would expect. I mean, we do see high-tech businesses fail, and they fail because they run out of funds, and they fail because the project they're trying to develop fails to deliver up to its promise. So they do fail. But you have all the other ancillary businesses that you'd expect in any economy, and they fail at the same sort of rates as anywhere else.
Finally, I'm getting a very strong sense from you that you get a real buzz out of taking something which is almost broken, or indeed broken, and fixing it. But how does it feel to work in a business which is all about other people's distress, if I can put it like that?
Well, the way I rationalise it in my mind is I'm a problem solver. People come to me with problems that they don't think are solvable. And because of what I do and how long I've done it, I know that there is always a solution. The question really is just how painful that solution is. And the earlier that people come and see me, the less painful the solution. The most painful is you come and see me on Thursday, can't pay the wage on Friday, you are shut on Friday. That is quite brutal and painful. Have the perception that I'm just going to come in and shut the door and close the business down. And some people have even sort of given me the keys at the first meeting and said, here you go, it's all yours now. It's like, no, that's not how it works. You know, we don't have debtors' prisons anymore, so people don't go to prison because they don't pay their debts. It's all a question of, there is always a solution out there, but you need to go through a little bit of pain to find what that solution is.
My thanks to Paul and Chris for taking part in today's show. During August, there will be the chance to catch up on a couple of episodes of In Your Company, which you might have missed earlier in the year. And while you listen in, I'll be working on the new show for September, which should be well worth waiting for. I'll be in the studio talking to serial technology entrepreneur Charles Cotton about what is by far and away the most important business story this region has ever produced, the so-called Cambridge phenomenon. We'll be looking at what the term actually means, what the phenomenon has achieved so far, and what influence it's likely to have on a local, national, and global basis in the years ahead. There will be contributions from those who helped shape the phenomenon's origins and from those driving its future growth. Please do join us for what is shaping up to be a fascinating show. In the meantime, if you have any questions or feedback, please email us. Our address is inyourcompany@cambridge105.fm. You can also follow us on Twitter @inyourcompany. All the previous editions of In Your Company are available as podcasts on the Cambridge 105 website. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.